Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here, presuming that today is January 12th, 2019, where you are, or if you're on the west side of the international dateline, the 13th, then the telephone number is 254-773-1400. Of course, if you're on the other side of the dateline, you'd have to put a 101 plus.
Yeah.
At the front end of that. You don't actually hit the plus. You just hit 01.
There's no plus on my phone. I've looked for it. It's just not there.
There's no parentheses either, but the area code has parentheses around it.
Yeah.
Oh, it'd be very difficult to dial.
So hard to dial.
Yep. And
there's not even a dial on my phone to dial anymore. It's just buttons.
And the bottom line to the stock market, we hit it early in the first hour, so we'll hit it again quickly, is that we took a nosedive of about 15%. In December, basically, although it occurred during the quarter, and from a high that we hit in September, and we have been gradually recovering since then. We're up about 10.4%, but because of the way statistics work, we're still down about 11% from the peak. So we're still kind of chugging along, and the big question mark is, despite all the brouhaha about the wall and the government shutdown, the big question mark still is a combination of several things, but the biggest one is whether or not we'll wind up with 25% tariffs on everything that comes out of China, which a lot of people think would throw us into a recession in 2019.
Now, there's some good news on the price front going into that, because that would, the tariffs, if they happen, would cause prices to go up on lots of things. One area where prices are going to be with a strong downward force, it may stay level, but there's definitely a force pushing it downward, is oil and gas. S&P Global, Platts Analytics, just forecast that the Permian oil production, Permian's being in Texas, is going to be doubling over the next 2 years. So they're expecting 5.5 million barrels a day out of Texas. That is getting up there close to, that's more than many nations in OPEC put out, and that's just Texas. We're talking about going from the number one oil producer in the world, if we just add just the Permian Basin's expected growth, we're going to be so far ahead of Russia and Saudi Arabia that there's nobody even coming close. And Mexico is feeling jealous over that. We talked about this during the break. And the president there, the new president, Obrador, and I'm not pronouncing that correctly, I'm positive, has instituted some changes on the energy front. We were talking about this earlier, so please chime in with your viewpoint on this too. But basically, he said he wants Mexico to be energy independent, and so he shut down sweet light crude imports. Sweet light crude, I love that. It's like somebody's tasting it. It's not really tasting. It's just the easiest to refine. The Mayan oil that they have is thick. It's not as thick as the Canadian tar sands, but it's pretty thick, and it needs light sweet crude to be mixed into it to make gasoline. So at the same time that he was doing that, they have a problem which last year amounted to about $2 billion, this isn't pesos, this is adjusted for dollars, $2 billion of theft of gasoline from the state company-owned pipelines. So the president shut off the pipelines. He just said, fine, there's going to be stealing from it, we're shutting them down. So all across Mexico right now, there are lines at the gas stations, and the trucking is having a lot of trouble getting food inside the big cities like Mexico City. There's a little minor crisis that started with basically saying, I want to be energy independent, and the best way to do that is to not accept any outside energy. There's a problem with that. You may want to do it gradually and give some incentives to your existing corporation. There's only one in Mexico that does it, to increase your own energy production. So that there's good news on the price front, bad news if you're in Mexico and you're dealing with gasoline.
Well, you know, a good domestically, oil, West Texas Intermediate crude, which is the benchmark for U.S. oil, is up above $50 now. It's 51 something.
Right.
That's a big plus, and I hate to say that. I mean, we like it when the price of oil drops below $50 because it results in dollar something at the gas pump. But frankly, in order the price of oil is generated by two things. One is supply, and the other one is demand. Supply changes slowly. Despite all the stuff we know about fracking, the limitation remains at the refinery and in the pipelines. And we have limitations on our ability to get the oil to market, thank God, which causes the supply side of things to have a lower effect than the demand side of things. And when the price of oil goes down in the futures contracts, which is what we report on, which is how oil is mainly bought and sold, it indicates that the people who are participating in the market see a slowing demand coming down the road. It is affected by supply, but that generally goes away fairly quickly. But mainly it's affected by demand. And the fact that it's up above $50, despite the fact the supply hasn't fallen off, is a very, very good sign in the economy. Now, there's not the only sign out there. The price of lumber has fallen by 2/3 since May.
Yeah.
Well, the housing starts are still down. There's a lot of indicators out there in the economy. The durable goods purchases and plans to purchase are down and falling.
Just as a side note, if you're planning a housing project, a house project in your house, a home improvement project of some kind, it's probably one of the cheapest times to do it in the last decade, based on prices of tile and prices of wire and prices of lumber and prices of glue. But all things related to home construction pricing is down right now. It's a pretty good idea to use the money appropriately.
But you really need to do it yourself if you're going to do this, because the price of services,
that's way up.
You know, the matter of fact, there's a Institute for Supply Management has an index, a manufacturing index and a service index. And the manufacturing index dropped from 59 to 54 the last time it was released, which was for December. So we're still waiting to see what the next number will be. And if it continues to fall, that indicates that we are sliding towards recession. 54 is above 50, so it's still growth. But the supply side is holding steady around 60, which means it's growing pretty darn. The activity is growing. The profits from it are growing. The demand is still there. The problem is, and I'm going to tell you, if you wanted to do some kind of deal around your house, is finding somebody to come in and do it. And when you finally do get somebody to come in and do it, be prepared to pay significantly more than you may have paid a couple of years ago.
And this is at least as important as understanding that part. Scam artists in that area are procreating. And I don't mean that in the literal sense.
They might actually be procreating. They're multiplying, at least.
Some people might even call them procreators, using a more slang term, because they are showing up and saying they're going to start doing work, and you pay half up front or some related figure, and they show up and they get their half up front, and then they don't show up again. They just disappear.
And you probably didn't do the research to find out if the corporation really existed and if it had insurance.
Or even better, this is where you got to be extra careful, because we've seen this happen to clients within the last month. They did a lot of research on a corporation, on a business that they got the bid from, who subcontracted to someone that the client didn't have any ability to do research on. And that subcontractor got paid and then didn't show up. And so then they've got to contact the main corporation and say, what's going on here? And the cases that we've looked at, that top-level corporation has wound up paying, basically eating the cost of a subcontractor that didn't work properly. But anytime you have a boom in a given area, whether that's marijuana stocks, Bitcoin at the height, construction services right now, it attracts the scam artists. It looks like easy money. If you can make $50 an hour by carrying a hammer. And you really don't even have to swing the hammer if you can scam the people out of it. So do your homework and make sure that the people that you're hiring are bonded. That's a vital thing, and it's not something that people really have looked at much for a long time, because for a decade, that's been an area where if somebody could get a job, they'd be happy to do it. And now everybody that wants a job in that area already has the job, and there's a huge demand for more. If you want to get your electricity fixed, your wiring done, expect to pay for it. It's not going to be cheap. That's one area where services, the inflation rate has been a lot higher than the overall inflation rate.
One of the big things that's going on in the economy right now, by the way, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400 if today is January 12th, 2019. One of the things that's going on in the economy is, and it causes a lot of disruption and confusion, is massive displacement. And it's happening in almost every aspect of the economy. We were talking about oil just a moment ago. It used to be that we knew where the oil was and we knew where it was coming from. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, they were talking about peak oil, that we basically found all the oil that we could profitably pull out of the
Right.
ground.
It's all going to be disappearing shortly.
Yeah, about now, by the way, oil is supposed to was supposed to be approaching $1,000 a barrel, according to the projections
Yeah.
done 20 years ago.
And we talked about this 20 years ago, before fracking was a real thing. We said all it takes is oil to be at $100 a barrel and it's profitable to figure out how to get it out of the shale. It got up to $100 a barrel and hung out there for a year and fracking was born. So it's something that economists are well aware of. If you get a price maintained at a certain level that makes it profitable to do research, research happens and they find better ways of doing it.
The other things that are going on are kind of obvious, but they happen gradually. A very simple one, I've talked about this before, is the fact that when you call a company, you very rarely talk to a receptionist. The receptionists have been replaced by computers. The other thing, and this is a one that you probably notice the impact, despite the fact we had a 5.1% increase in Christmas spending, it looks like. We haven't, the Commerce Department is closed, so we haven't got final numbers. Macy's is in a hurt.
Yeah.
The big department stores in the malls are in a hurt because we've had a shift. We've had a major shift to online shopping, and it is accelerating. And these major shifts cause major disruptions. And it's one of those things that we probably ought to get used to. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. I enjoy listening to your show. I was wondering if you could explain to me what the big deal about the national deficit is. It seems to me all my life I've been hearing about this. And I remember I was in New York about 15 years ago, and there's this big sign on a building, and I was standing on the corner just watching the national deficit tick up every second by thousands of dollars. And it seems like I've been hearing about it all my life, and nothing ever happens about it, and people just talk about it. And what's the big deal about it? Because maybe you could come back 10 years from now, it might be $40 trillion, and they'll still be talking about it. So I was just wondering, why is it such a big deal, and what does it really mean? Because nothing really seems to happen about it. It seems to me there's too many people in big positions that would have too much to lose if something really happened. So
Well,
what's the big deal about it?
let me put it this way. You pay taxes every year, right?
Yes.
The percentage of your taxes has been going up the whole time that is applicable to paying interest on the national debt. Now, we just went through a period of time with very, very low interest, with the government rolling over its debt to shorter and shorter terms with very, very low interest, which is cool.
Cool for the short term, but we got to refinance that debt at
But
generally higher rates for longer periods of time.
it's very much the same situation that would occur in your household if you were graduate, if you're only spending 5% more than you make each year. For a long time, it won't make any difference. You'll just be gradually allocating larger and larger amounts to making the minimum payment on your credit card, right?
And sometimes that means that every year, because you're paying that interest payment, you're paying more than 5% into the debt. It's just getting bigger and bigger.
But if you decided to increase your spending and you changed your job to be one that was more pleasant to you but had a lower income, but you continued to raise, you decided to continue to raise your spending. Would you agree that at some point, for a long time, nothing happens except that you have slightly larger numbers on your credit card bills, right?
And a parent or a friend might tell you, hey, you can't keep doing that. And they may have started telling you that 20 years ago.
Well, the projections right now, and they're pretty, we're getting more and more accurate as they occur, are that sometime in the early 2030s or late 2020s, probably in the very early 2030s, we're going to hit the crunch. We're going to hit the point where the interest on the national debt is larger than the defense budget, where Social Security no longer has a reserve and the government is having to dump lots of money into Social Security payments, more than is coming in. They're already doing that, by the way.
Yeah, and this isn't hard math, by the way. You can look up these numbers and just look ahead. Even assuming interest rates don't change, which is a really silly assumption, it's not very far out there before interest costs more than defense.
You know, it's kind of like if you've got a house or a boat, and boat is probably more accurate, and it needs ongoing maintenance on it, and you just choose not to do it, eventually it's going to bite you. If you got a car that you choose not to change the oil on because you want to, because you don't feel like changing the oil on the car, you're just going to keep running the car. Well, sooner or later, it's going to bite you.
You've got teeth in your boats in your car. I try to get mine that don't have mouths or teeth. I don't like being bitten by my vehicles. It's just
it was a metaphorical bite.
Oh, okay. All right.
But the point is that the reason people worry about it is because over the long term, it's not sustainable. The dollar is based on, the value of the dollar is based on a limited number of them being in circulation. And we have only so many dollars that come into the federal government, and a bigger and bigger chunk of that with each passing year is now going to pay the debt. Now, we cheated the last year or two. Well, actually, the last 2 years we cheated. We had very, very low interest rates because of the recession. And so we moved the rollover on the federal debt to the very short term, which means that sometime around 2020 or 2021, a lot of that debt is going to come out of 1% and 2% interest rate positions and going to have to be paid at 3% if it's short term, out to maybe 4 or 5 or 6% longer term. And that is going to have a, that is going to make a bigger, that's going to take a bigger and bigger, excuse the metaphor, bite out of the federal budget. And it is a brick wall that we're charging towards at a high rate of speed. And it's one of those things where it's the same thing as somebody says, if you don't maintain your house, if you don't replace your roof when it leaks, yeah, you can go along for a lot of years and not worry about it.
Decades until
the black mold sets in and all of a sudden your house is worthless.
Right. So the idea here, important concept, is the U.S. government finances its debt using balloon notes. Anybody that's been in business and has gotten a loan knows what a balloon note is. It means that at the end of the loan, all of the principal is due. You may have paid some principal and some interest during the length of the loan, but whatever else is still owed is owed all at once. So all the debt that we've been acquiring over the last several years, or the vast, vast majority of it, has been in two-year notes. And as those mature, we have to refinance it at a higher interest rate. There's no prospect right now, zero prospect, of paying it back, really literally paying it back. It has to be refinanced. This is something we can look forward to. And one law that is a law in economics, there aren't that many laws, it's the law of supply and demand. The supply that we're talking about here is the federal debt. And if there's a lot of it, you've got a huge supply.
What I think
and
is
the demand for it is not is at a fixed rate. In some cases, it's falling. We're getting a lower demand from our overseas purchasers. There's less Chinese purchasing, less Japanese purchasing than there's been for decades.
Yeah, and that's a crucial issue, not because the Chinese don't like us or because they don't like the dollar or because they're trying to do anything political. The fact is the Chinese economy is slowing, and it is reaching conceivably the point where instead of having lots of extra money, by the way, if the president got his way and they stopped doing so many exports to the United States, they would also stop buying
bonds from the United States.
They take the extra money that they get from the fact that they export more to us, and they take a big chunk of that and they loan it back to the United States to cover our debt. If you remove the Chinese from buying debt of the United States,
interest rates are going to go way up.
Yeah, you're going to have
a supply demand issue.
You're going to have a sudden jump in interest rates, and the cost of our debt jumps accordingly. And I think what will happen is at some point, and it could be 10 years from now, it could be 12 years from now, it could be 14 years from now, I don't know. At some point, we'll hit a crisis. And the crisis will be that we see interest rates going up quickly, which, by the way, the end of the 2020s is the most likely time I think I see that happen, when it looks like we're simply not going to be able to pay the debt back, and the only way to get out of the debt is to allow runaway inflation to deplete the dollar. And if that's called a collapse of a currency. And at that point, people are going to demand higher and higher and higher interest rates. And it becomes, you just don't want to get into the position where the only money
the
you
70s.
Can get is from high. Yeah, in the 1970s, that's what happened. And we tend to do that every 50 years or so. And I would certainly hope we don't do it again. But there's a lot of people who agree with me. And unfortunately, the Republicans decided to go from let's not accumulate too much debt to let's accumulate the maximum possible debt and then spend more money and then take money off the budget and accumulate even more debt.
Yeah, and this is a complaint you'll hear from fiscally conservative people everywhere right now. They feel abandoned by the Republicans. That was the party of the fiscal conservatives. If you consider it from a home perspective, there's some dangers in this analogy in that the home is not the same as the government. But again, if you're building up large amounts of debt that you have to refinance, that debt because it's going to balloon, you can look ahead and expect to be paying more money in the future just because you're still acquiring more debt plus the stuff that you've got to refinance. So that's as long as your debt's growing at a slower rate than your growth in income, it's all good because you're spending a smaller and smaller percentage of your income on the debt. But if your debt's growing faster than your income by a significant amount, the piper needs to get paid.
Now, let me put a caveat in there. If the debt is growing for capital investment, and the capital investment is going to make you money in the future that is greater than your cost of the borrowing, debt is a very good thing. It is what makes the wheels turn of the economy and makes everything work. For example, let me give you, and I want to give you a recent political example. If instead of cutting taxes by $1.5 trillion, actually it was a lot more than that, but we had left taxes alone, because the economy is running at full tilt at that point, and invested and borrowed $1.5 trillion and put it into the infrastructure systems of the United States so that we could make more money, we could have a greater capacity to grow into the future, I would have supported that 100% because we need about $4 trillion invested in our federal infrastructure, bridges and roads and internet and all of that, to enable the economy to grow larger than it is today. We've hit our limitations. That would also apply to the fact we need some immigration reform, and we need a series of things done.
Infrastructure.
Yeah, it would cost
spending,
us money.
Yeah.
You know, and in other words, if you open up low wage people coming into the United States, yeah, initially they're going to cost us some money. So let's budget for that, and let's get the training out of the way, and let's put them to work because the jobs are going begging. And so the issue is, if we took $1.5 trillion and said we're going to invest this in things that will enable the economy to grow faster in the future, yeah, I'd go for that 100%. But simply say, let's take $1.5 trillion and give it to corporations mainly, and also to people who pay taxes. Let's take $1.5 trillion and give it to them. We knew in advance what was going to happen. Stock buybacks. and speculative investments and a bunch of stuff that doesn't produce much of anything in the economy. We knew that was going to happen. All the economists said it was going to happen. But it's also a really popular thing to do, and it would give the jolt in the arm for the 2018 elections, and it did, which is why the Senate stayed in the Republicans' hands. I mean, it was cool. But the piper is going to be paid on this, and I suspect we're going to start seeing the effects around 2020.
Yeah.
At like 10 years from now. So would you
not 10 years from now.
That's next year.
That's next year. Well,
2020 is only a year away.
2030 is when the big hit probably will come, and that will be a full-blown crisis if we don't. We could deal with it between now and then.
It'd be nice if we would.
And we could say we're going to have to raise taxes, and gradually, because I think the 2020s are going to be boom years. And during the boom years, if we increase the taxes and we adjust our system, we could wind up in a position where we coast into 2020 and into 2030 with a low national debt.
Oh, okay.
And that would leave us a lot of room to borrow money, a bunch of money going into the next recession.
Now, the danger of that is that we do exactly what we did in 1929, which we coasted into 1929, having dealt with the debt from World War I. We paid it back, and then we hit 1929 and went into deflation instead of the other way around.
Because we refused to borrow any money.
Right.
Because
we just paid it all off.
We went from the fact of, like we are today, we're saying debt is a wonderful thing to saying debt is a horrible thing.
Now that's a spectrum. We go back and forth on that.
And it is
spectrum.
Neither wonderful nor horrible. It is something that needs to be managed.
It's kind of like saying the circular saw is a horrible tool. I can't get this nail hammered in very well. It's a tool that has a use. You apply the use for the tool, not trying to bang in hammers. I mean, it's not a hammer, not trying to bang in the nails. You use it to cut wood, and debt for the U.S. government, there are rules around it. It is never all good. It is never all bad.
I was just wondering that if one day some kind of a huge calamity would happen because of this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if we keep going as is, then 2030, we've got a massive catastrophe.
If we don't get some mature approaches to this, and by the way, for whatever it's worth, in the 1990s during the boom, admittedly there were some things bad going on during that period of time, but the government's activities during the 1990s ultimately resulted in us starting to pay down the debt. Which, by the way, had we continued with that policy.
That was Newt Gingrich, by the way. We'll give the credit where it's due. That was the balanced budget.
He had cooperation from the president.
Right. The president signed it. Bill Clinton signed the balanced budget act.
And had we done that going into 2007, we would have been in relatively great. Admittedly, the bubble might have occurred in mortgages because they chose to take a hands-off on regulation on derivatives. But we would have been in a position where we had ample reserves to apply to that recession to blunt the effect far more than we did.
Did you say apple reserves?
Ample.
Oh, man. I was hoping for some cider. Anyway, we got some commercials to play. Thanks very much for the call.
I appreciate your answer there.
Yeah. And we will be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call us at
254-773-1400.
And we'll be back.
We're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the real con.
Yeah, he's
is standing
in the room.
Here with his Trump Make America Great Again 2020 hat on.
Yes.
Trying to think of some way out of this dilemma of spending more money than you've got.
Well,
that's
what we've been talking about.
Solving the dilemma of spending more money than you got.
And
there's an easy solve. Stop spending money, but it causes other problems, and that's the problem with the problem.
Our obligations now are so large, and I've been there as a business person. Obligations are so large that we have to pay, that we really can't cut spending. You know, people talk about the potential, well, let's just cut foreign aid. We could cut all foreign aid. We could cut all food stamps.
You're talking about a percent. Well, it's a fraction of a percent of the budget.
Yeah, and the point is
the foreign aid.
It would have no significant effect on the deficit.
But you think about it, the only real power that a politician has is the power to spend more money. So if you're spending more money than you're bringing in, what is the end result of that somewhere in the future, 2030, 2040, whatever.
It ain't going to be 2040. It'll be
maybe sooner.
Much quicker.
Sooner. Yeah, it's really hard to get elected by saying, you know all the benefits that you have? I'm getting elected by cutting those.
Well, but the point is, we did it.
We've done it before, yeah.
You know, and you don't have to cut. What you have to do is say, all we'd have to do, and admittedly it'd be really hard to do at this point, is say, guess what? That tax cut was a mistake.
Well, and also stop spending so much.
Well,
you know,
where do you cut spending?
Well, every time they pass a new budget bill, they increase the spending.
Okay, now there you go. Now, stop increasing spending.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, right. I completely agree with you. And that's our objection to the wall. We've said this is our objection to the wall. Really simple. Put a surcharge, a percentage surcharge on all income taxes in the United States to pay for that wall bill. And I'll support the bill.
I like going old school. Back when Congress, when they passed a spending bill that was more spending than they had money to spend, they had to pass a brother or sister law with it to get the borrowing. There was a law that went with it to say this spending bill is being paid for by this borrowing bill.
Or, well, that's what we do at the county level and at the state level. We say we can issue a bond. We're going to build a building, so we're going to issue a bond, and we're also going to raise taxes on your property, for example, by this many cents to pay off that bond each year over the next 20 years.
And there was a bipartisan movement by Congress to say to the Treasury Department, we're just going to set a spending limit, a debt ceiling, and you just let us know when we need to increase that. That separated them from the decision of borrowing, and it made it look like the executive branch was the one that was doing the borrowing when it's the Congress that's doing it. And if we go back to that original passive borrowing law, you know, the danger that you just said that there was a bill that's been introduced, you said this last hour, by the Democrats to say, let's just have the debt ceiling automatically go up with spending. Well, then they don't even have to look at the credit card bill for all the spending that they're doing. Somebody's going to pay for it. And the problem is that they're the ones that have to pay for it, and eventually we're the ones that have to pay for it.
If I had a political complaint, Con, and this is one I've asked the conservatives to please comment on, my political complaint is very, very simple. The Republicans in Congress were willing to shut the government down over the size of the debt, and once they got control, they jacked the debt up to an astronomical level. Not only did they cut taxes, but they also dramatically increased spending, and now they want to increase spending again without more taxes. I feel betrayed.
Well, it doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or Republican. When they are buying votes with our money, with budget money, and that's what they're doing, Republican, Democrats, both, their real power is the power to spend money. And if they are spending money to increase welfare, whatever the thing may be.
That includes defense. We were saying the Defense Department needed some more money, well, but we got to figure out where we're paying for that money.
Now, I don't mind. By the way, let me go on record here and say I think the $300 billion increase in defense spending was a good investment. Why do I think it's a good investment? Because the United States economy is dependent upon international commerce. International commerce and stability is critical for our economy to work, and our military is the one that maintains it around the world.
Yeah, based on that law, we've got two new aircraft carriers mm-hmm. being developed at the same time, which we haven't done for a long, long time, and it's important that we do because China's building aircraft carriers and Russia's building aircraft carriers, and we don't want to have our 1970s era aircraft carriers going up against the 2018 aircraft carriers.
My point is, when they passed the $300 billion increase in defense budget, they should have said, okay, we are going to issue this many 30-year bonds or 20-year bonds to cover $300 billion, and we will also increase taxes enough to make the payments on those bonds. We know what the interest rate is going to be as soon as they're issued. We'll increase tax rates enough to cover that for the next 20 or 30 years. I would say that is fiscal responsibility.
Well, it's not comfortable.
But another question I have is, when is it increased in efficiency, or is it just increase in waste? I have bought a lot of government surplus in my lifetime, as well as corporate surplus. And I'm telling you, the waste of our federal government is unbelievable.
Well, it is. But I also say that the waste, there have been a series of bills passed over the past 20 years. They've dramatically reduced the waste in the federal government.
And fraud.
And fraud. And there's a point.
But we spend a lot of money on preventing waste and fraud, which is another expense.
Let me give you an example of that. We had a Allen wrench when I was a commander in our tool room that was made out of special metal so it wouldn't flake and it wouldn't break and all that. So it was a fairly expensive Allen wrench. It cost about $15.
Which at the time was like $3,000 inflation adjusted back from 1836.
This was not during the Civil War. Anyway, we had this Allen wrench in there. And in the interest of cutting waste and fraud, if we lost that Allen wrench, like we're out in the rainstorm in the middle of the dark in the field where we couldn't use lights and somebody drops it in the mud and it's gone. It required a report of survey that took approximately 25 hours of an officer's time, not to mention all the NCO's time and everybody else. It cost us over $3,000.
I knew that number was going to come in somewhere.
To account for a $15 Allen wrench. And there's a point beyond which waste is just going to happen.
Well, but some of it is just pure stupidity or inexperience. I don't know what it is, but I bought three machines, and I won't necessarily go into too big a story here, but I bought three machines that would have a life expectancy of all 30,000 hours.
Mm-hmm.
One of them had 365 hours on it. One of them had 304 hours on it. I'm still using the one that had 304 hours on it. I've been using it for 10 or 12 years, and I bought it for, maybe 1/100th of what the government bought it for.
Yep.
Wow.
Just pure,
and believe me, I understand it. It happens, but as a percentage of the total budget, that's the question.
Now I have to throw this in here just to lighten the conversation a minute. You were talking about Allen wrenches. You know what the inventor of the flathead screwdriver said when he was looking at the Phillips screwdriver and the Allen wrench? You can name them after yourself?
Okay. Thank you for that.
Okay. Well,
appreciate it, Con.
We appreciate your perspective on things, Con.
Well, sometimes it's a little bit different. But,
well, you know that Con is actually the super powerful semi god that rules about half the universe. Well, he's on Star Trek.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's because I've been there and somebody else hadn't.
All right. See, so we've had Con take over the studio here for a few minutes, which he has the right to do just like he does on the deck of the Star Trek. But this is
right.
On the deck of the Enterprise. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, 773-1400, area 2254.
I think you were confusing Con with Q. Con was a person, and Q was an entity. See.
Con was a person?
Yeah, Wrath of Con is all about a guy that
worms
in
right.
ears.
That's right. So. I had Con confused with Q.
Yeah, but, you know, they're both important entities.
Right, yeah. Right. That's right. So we got to watch out for the Q ball. But you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, as I said. There's a very interesting statistic that popped up. I love interesting statistics, and that is
probably only interesting to us, but we're going to allow you the potential for interest.
Over the last 12 months, the average wage of a wage earner in the United States, this is non-self-employed, non-agricultural.
These are employed people.
Right, has risen 3.1%. But when you look at how that's divided, it goes all over the place, and it is pretty much the way you'd kind of think of it. A job that requires thinking, that requires a college education.
Or at least a lot of skills.
Basically, we define college education job as a group rose closer to 6%.
High-skill jobs
are up.
About 5%.
But the non-college education required, we can identify, to get this job, you don't need a college education. People put that on, they check that off on
don't
the box.
Don't need a lot of skills and experience. There you go.
They didn't rise at all. And that's a double whammy because a big part of our economy and the workers in our economy don't have college educations. And when I say college education, that includes 2 years or technical school. You know, so when we talk about skilled jobs, most skilled jobs now require some form of higher education. So the issue is that education is making a big difference. And the double whammy is when you turn around and look at the jobs that are likely to be replaced by automation over the next decade. It's the same jobs where the price didn't go up. The prime example is the person flipping hamburgers at McDonald's. There are machines already that can do that. And there's machines that can do a lot of things. It's just currently the wages and benefits that we have to pay an employee to do it are still cheaper than putting a machine in there.
And this is
that's going to change over time.
Right. We're beginning to see it. One of my favorite examples is a house construction. Because in my childhood, when you walked by the sounds of a construction site, when you walked by, you heard saws that sounded like the kind of like the snoring, sawing logs sound.
And you heard the bang, bang, bang,
bang,
bang,
bang, bang, bang, bang. And a lot of people talking to each other, a lot of people on the site. In the buildup to the recession, you heard pop, 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 zing, zing sounds as the saws were mechanized and the nail guns were starting. You still heard bang, 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 bang occasionally. And you saw these really long extension cords, like a network all over the floor of the construction site. Come forward to today, the extension cords are missing. The air tubing that goes to the nail guns is missing. It's battery powered. There are plugs that have battery chargers in them, and you have maybe a quarter to a third of the people on the site as you did before the recession.
And
that's about a tenth of what was there in my childhood.
And more you don't hear the zing even, because the boards are pre-cut.
And they're showing up to the site with a label on them.
They're pre-cut en masse by a robotic machine. They pre-cut and they basically say, this is a kit, you're going to put it together this way.
Right. And the next step is not that far away. We're talking 5-10 years for the mainstream new constructions to have machines on site, mobile machines that are putting up walls, mobile machines that are cutting the holes for the electrical wire if they're not already cut, and running those wires. This is not far away. And what does that do for our expectations for jobs that right now are very valuable jobs, very much like the truck driving role? There's not enough people doing construction, so they're getting paid from, you know, pre 2006, the wage for a construction earner was $8 to $10 an hour. And you're getting up closer to $20 an hour now just for your normal construction person. In two decades, there may be one person on the site, maybe nobody on the site as the machines do the work. That's a huge shift. It's a massive shift from what we've seen in the past. We expect to see more of that. And I said this yesterday in a meeting, and I think it's important. We're talking about a recession happening in 2020 or maybe late in 2019. And I think it's important to point something out here. Very important. Even as you're cheating on your steps over there, he's waving his arm around to see if he's getting extra steps on his watch. As we hit this next, it's kind of a cyclical recession that we're expecting. It's not the big one, not the secular. One of the biggest hits is unemployment in situations like that. And, you know, there's the old joke between the difference between a recession and a depression. A recession is when somebody else lost their job. Depression's when you lost yours.
Mm-hmm.
Going into the next recession, we're already scheduled for a lot of baby boomers to be leaving the workforce, which means that the layoffs are preset. They're already in the system. It's going to be easier on the younger workers and harder on the older workers going into the next recession. Keep that in mind. It means that the overall unemployment numbers are not going to be as heavily impacted, and a lot of the other expenses that we see happening are going to continue to happen. That's going to keep funding the economy.
I'm going to make a forecast, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, because forecasts are not guaranteed. They do tend to happen, but we're going to go into a recession probably in 2020. And when we do go into the recession, whether it's in 2020 or 2021 or 2019, more likely 2020, we're going to see the same thing that happens in every recession, which is as people get laid off, only a portion of them will ultimately get rehired on the other side. And a lot of the people who get laid off are going to be replaced by automation. And that will accelerate into the 2020s. We will continue to have a labor shortage. How do I know we're going to have a labor shortage? We ain't having enough babies, folks.
Yep.
We're barely replacing. We're not quite natively replacing our population. We're cutting back on immigration. So if the economy is going to expand, we have to have a lot of automation. And I think we'll see in the 2020s the same thing we saw in the 1920s. And if you look at the transportation industry, the people who are likely to be replaced with automation, I won't say AI, it's not really AI, with automation, it's approximately the same percentage that were working in agriculture in the 1920s, who were replaced by the tractor and the pickup truck and the truck. And I think we're going to see the same thing happen in the 2020s. We're going to see a massive displacement of a lot of low-skilled or technical-skilled workers, but are very narrow technical skills.
There's good news on that front as well,
mm-hmm.
in that as of 2017, the Census Bureau put this out. People above the age of 55, about 30% of them are college-educated. People between the ages of 25 and 34, 37%.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a much larger percentage of younger people with college degrees, but it's still not 100%. There's still a lot of people that are going to need to be retrained or get completely new skills, figuring out they're going to get displaced in this coming thing.
We have to approach higher education in a more rational fashion,
yeah.
rather than simply saying, get a college degree in anything and you'll sure enough have a high-paying job no matter how much debt you accumulate, which is the philosophy today. I think Goldman Sachs came out with an interesting subject in that at least 20% of student loans over the next 10 years will fail.
Yeah.
In other words, people won't be able to pay them off.
And that's a government issue
as
well.
And you can't declare bankruptcy and get out from under them, so this depresses the housing businesses. Somebody's going to have to pass a forgiveness bill.
There's one out there already, but it's really hard to use, and it hasn't come up to the 10-year
right.
point from the time it passed, so it'll be coming up relatively soon.
At some point, we will need to address the fact that there will be a lot of people with overwhelming debt who can't get out from under it.
And the negative, there's a negative aside from the overwhelming debt. Some of the revenue to the United States government comes from interest payments on student loans.
Yes.
Federal loans are a direct income to the U.S. government. It is revenue that goes into the general revenue coffers. If we have interest rates rise on our long-term debt, we also have them rise on the long-term debt for
mm-hmm. You're right.
For college education. The issue is, should we be charging people that go to college, allowing colleges to raise the rates however they like, and charging the students, or should we be fixing that somehow?
There's a rational way of doing it. We can talk about it another time.
Yeah,
in Europe,
we're out of time.
That seems to work pretty well without producing overwhelming debt, and I think we'll eventually have to go to that. Anyway, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and if you would like to contact us off the air, we do personal wealth management for people with families mainly, with people with higher net worth. And the telephone number locally is 254-947-1111. You can also call that number if you have something that you just want us to talk about on the air. Or you can contact us by email at
Jeff@tpwc.com or Jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There's podcasts from the radio. There are newsletters going back quite a long way. See what we were saying before this downturn in the market, if you haven't remembered already. Until next week, this has been the Personal Wealth Coach. Thanks for listening.